and we're sorry we were a bit late getting started today, but we're delighted to welcome Iowa Grant High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you. We're happy to have you. You may be seated. The Iowa Grant High School students are with us with our Court with Class program. It's a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. We invite high school students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. And if they do, they're sent your briefs. The students may have done additional work on this case, and then the students will meet with a justice after our second case and discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues raised in these cases. Anyone who wishes to join the students and the justice is welcome to do that. These students should have been prepared on briefs with the case, but if anyone would like a synopsis of this case, summaries are available in the foyer, or if you prefer not to go get one, if you raise your hand, the Marshall Nodolf will bring one to you. Let me now introduce the court. On our far left is Justice Lewis Butler, and he has a special guest today, and that's Aaron Wells. Mr. Wells would stand. Mr. Wells is Justice Butler's nephew, and he is shadowing Justice Butler for today and yesterday, and is interested in perhaps being a lawyer. And as I said yesterday, I hope the lawyers do not dissuade him. Seated next to Justice, thank you, Mr. Wells. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Robinsack. With those introductions made, we'll call our first case today. 01-2789-02-2979, State v. Ralph D. Armstrong. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Armstrong will be Jerome, is it Buting or Budding? Buting. And Barry Sheck, and on behalf of the state is Sally Wellman, and you, Mr. Buting, will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Buting.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jerome Buting, and I, along with Professor Barry Sheck, are here on behalf of Ralph Armstrong today. With the court's indulgence, it's my intent to take the first 15 minutes. Mr. Sheck will then follow with 10 minutes, and then we'll reserve 5 for rebuttal.
Have you divided the issues?
No.
Okay. You're open to all questions. Thank you.
Although I'm primarily going to be dealing with the facts initially, so.
Okay.
Almost 25 years ago, a young lady by the name of Cherise Camps was brutally murdered right here in Madison. Ralph Armstrong was arrested and later convicted of this crime, and yet from the day of his arrest till now, he has always maintained that he is innocent of this horrible crime. We now have DNA evidence that backs him up. DNA evidence that not only excludes him from crucial crime scene evidence, but also now has developed a profile that points to another, as yet unidentified individual. We believe that this new evidence warrants a new trial for Mr. Armstrong under any standards, including the standard used by the Court of Appeals, that is the clear and convincing evidence of a reasonable probability of a different result. To understand why we think this evidence is so important, I think it's important that I have to direct the Court's attention to this crime scene photograph. It's in the appendix, App 126. This is the very same photograph that went into the jury room for deliberations. It's the very same photograph that this court, on direct appeal, approved going into the jury room for deliberations because this court found, quote, it would assist the jury in their assessment of the physical evidence connecting the defendant to the crime. Now, the only thing that's in this photograph that can do that is the pink bathrobe belt that's crumpled on the floor next to the victim's body, and more importantly, the pink bathrobe belt, which has been clearly taken out of the bathrobe itself, and its position laying across the back of the deceased body makes it clear beyond any doubt that it was handled by the true killer, used in some fashion. We're not clear, but the pathologist did determine that she was murdered and that the probable cause of death was strangulation. Now, at the trial, the central issue, with a lot of side issues going on as well, but the central issue that the jury had to decide was the identity of the killer. And in order to establish that, the state used extensively and relied upon expert testimony from a crime lab expert. And they set it up with their opening statement where the prosecutor told the jury to, quote, listen closely to what the crime lab expert would say about the pink bathrobe and the pink bathrobe belt. And then, in fact, the expert did testify and consumed more time than any other witness that the state used the entire trial, testified for over 100 pages of transcript, I believe. And she testified that she found a semen stain on that bathrobe belt and that Ralph Armstrong's blood type was in that stain, that he could not be excluded from it. She also testified that there were two head hairs found on this bathrobe belt and that they were both consistent with or similar to Mr. Armstrong. The prosecutor didn't go even further.
Mr. Buehling, let me interrupt you for just a minute. What's the difference between similar to or consistent with? Is one more important than the other?
Under the testimony at trial, and you know, this testimony is now, that whole science has become very much suspect with the advent of DNA evidence that's tending to disprove a lot of it. But as I understand it, it was a microscopic analysis in which a number of characteristics matched or didn't match. And the more that matched, it would be consistent with if there were less but still significant number of characteristics that were shared between the unknown hair and the standard, that is, in this case, the suspects, then it would be considered similar to. But the prosecutor went much further than that in his closing. He said, quote, there was physical evidence at the scene, physical evidence to demonstrate conclusively that Ralph Armstrong is the person who murdered Cherise Camps. And then, a few minutes later, he picked up this very photograph, dramatically displaying it to the jury. And he pointed, and the transcript says, he said, this is it, lying on top of Cherise Camps' body. Two of the defendant's hairs are on that belt. He then went so far as to say that there was no explanation, quote unquote, no explanation for Ralph Armstrong's hairs being in that location on that belt other than the fact that he killed Cherise Camps. He also pointed to the bathroom belt, to the bathrobe itself and reminded the jury that Ralph Armstrong's blood type A secretor, was found in a semen stain on that belt, which later was used to bolster a potential sexual motive. We now know, he then even went further. In his rebuttal, closing portion of his rebuttal argument, he said, quote, the physical evidence of Ralph Armstrong at the scene ties him irrevocably to the murder of Cherise Camps. We now know that all of those claims are wrong. They're not true. Mr. Armstrong has been excluded by DNA from the semen stain that was found in the bathrobe, and he's been excluded by DNA from both of the head hairs that were found on the bathrobe belt lying atop her bloody body. And those tests also prove that those two head hairs did not come from the victim, and they did not come from the victim's boyfriend.
Counselor, isn't it true there were also about 20 other hairs that didn't come from anybody that could be identified, and there were pet hairs that were found, and she never even had a pet?
That's correct.
So aren't these just two more hairs that we can't identify because those other hairs were also talked about in some detail in Ms. Wagner's testimony?
That's why this photo that went to the jury is so important, Your Honor, because none of those hairs were found on the victim's body.
These were found on the belt, as I understand it, not on the body.
That's correct.
And the belt was taken out of the robe. The robe's on the floor. Why are we to assume that the hairs jumped on top of the belt when it was on top of the body rather than something that was picked up on the floor like the pet hairs were and all those other hairs that weren't identified?
Well, keep in mind another important fact, and that I was just about to get to, and that is that the two head hairs match each other. The DNA sequence matches, which therefore makes it extremely likely that they came from one and the same person.
Well,
so the state's argument that there's an innocent explanation for these hairs, that the floating hair that can float about the environment, the chances of two of them from the same person coming down, not the victim, not the boyfriend, not Armstrong, but coming down onto this belt, makes it very likely and certainly a reasonable doubt, a reasonable inference for the jury to have considered, had they known it, that points to someone else as the murderer.
You know, it points to there being somebody else's hair, but there are 20 other hairs at least that were identified, some pubic and some head hair. These were head hairs that they don't know who they belong to, and that's in the testimony in the record too. Aren't we to consider that along with your proof through DNA identification that these don't belong to Mr. Armstrong and they don't belong to Mr. Dillman, the boyfriend, and they don't belong to Ms. Camps?
The other hairs, I don't know whether they belong to Mr. Dillman or not, but I know that those two hairs that were tested, that were in the most incriminating place possible, and the two hairs that this court said this evidence, this photograph would assist the jury in linking Armstrong to the crime, we're talking about the semen and the hairs on the belt here. There's no other hairs that were described. The other hairs that you're talking about were on the floor and the bathroom.
Why are we talking about the facts? We're talking about the facts and we're talking about whether the evidence was properly identified as coming from your client because it is obligatory for either you or the state, and that's one of the issues, to show that there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome. Is that right? I mean, are we on the fifth test of new evidence?
Yes.
I do want to ask a question, Chief, and that is on the hair samples that you tested, responding to the question of Justice Robinsack. Did you test, were the other hairs tested? I'm talking about from a DNA sample. Were they tested?
A pubic hair was tested, and it was also excluded. It also excluded Armstrong.
Well, there were a number of pubic. There were, what, nine pubic hairs?
Nine pubic hairs, none of which, even at the trial, were linked to Mr. Armstrong. So even at the trial, they were excluded. One of those, five of them were believed to be the victims. The other four were unknown. One of those we did test.
So you only tested? No, that's what I wanted to know. How many hair samples did you test?
Three. And none of them matched Armstrong, and none of them matched Dillman.
Three out of how many hairs were there? You tested three of?
Well, there was a total of four unknown pubic hairs on the bedspread. But it's also important for the court.
So out of how many hairs, you tested three from DNA, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And the rest you did not test?
The rest we did not test. But the state, by stipulation, was permitted to test, and they either did and found them to be unhelpful, or they didn't at all because they never introduced any evidence about them.
We will ask the state. Thank you.
I'm assuming you tested the ones that the state used to show that Mr. Armstrong's hair was present. The others didn't go to the jury to incriminate Mr. Armstrong, right?
That is correct.
And your problem is that you want to attack a conviction on the basis of evidence presented in that trial that points to Mr. Armstrong and was persuasive to the jury, right?
Correct.
Okay. What do you have to do here to get a new trial? That's what you want, right?
Right.
Okay.
And there's a couple of ways that the court could go about this. And one way, and perhaps the easiest, is the interest of justice standard, because this case is very, very much like State v. Hicks. When this court determines that the real controversy has not been fully tried, and in that instance, you don't even have to find a reasonable probability of a different result. The court just finds in the interest of justice a new trial is warranted. And the reason I think that that one in particular applies here so much is because there are two factors the court considers in that. One is whether evidence was erroneously or wrongly admitted that would cloud the jury's ability to decide some of the central issues, which in this case would be the jury being told that there was physical evidence leaking Ralph Armstrong to the very body of the victim. And secondly, when important evidence was not presented to the jury, that goes to material fact. And that now on a new trial is what we would have. The jury would not only be told that Armstrong was excluded, but so was the victim, and so was the boyfriend. And that there's an unknown individual now whose two head hairs were found on the victim's body. So I think it fits very closely with Hicks. And
Buting, let me interrupt you at this point. Why should we skip over the normal test in regard to newly discovered evidence and jump immediately to the interests of justice?
You don't need to. I jumped over it only because I think Hicks is the only case that I've seen that presents a situation like this, which is what we would call a false fact or false evidence and conclusions type case, where not only is there it's the rational distinction that the Court of Appeals noticed, but there was no case law on, and that is where it's not just additional newly discovered evidence, but it's newly discovered evidence that proves that evidence that was used at the trial was wrong, and conclusions argued from it were wrong.
Well, is it your position that even if we look at this in the light of newly discovered evidence, the Boyce test, in other words, that you still win?
Yes.
You still ought to get a new trial?
Yes, absolutely. Because this evidence is so important and goes to the central, and this is what the Court of Appeals, one place the Court of Appeals erred in this is they refused to look at how the false evidence affected the jury, and they also refused to look at how it fits dynamically with all the other evidence in the case. What it did was, by there wrongly being evidence that appeared to link Armstrong to the murder, it helped corroborate otherwise weak evidence that the state had, and at the same time undermined the defendant's testimony and credibility, because he's saying he never killed her, he says he never had sex with her, but the jury's being told his semen's on that bathrobe and those are his two hairs on that bathrobe bell on top of the dead body.
Also, wasn't the jury told that the semen was consistent with his, but there was also testimony that it was consistent with her boyfriend, Mr. Dillman, correct?
That's correct.
And there was no semen on the body, there was only semen on the bathrobe.
That's correct. The problem is, it was one coincidence too many. The way that the state presented it, I see that my red light has come up, but that ultimately what happened...
You may answer. Okay. Justice Robinson.
What happened is that there was simply one coincidence too many to have that kind of evidence apparently linking Mr. Armstrong, two head hairs, not just one, two, was more, I think, than the jury could use to otherwise find a reasonable doubt.
Thank you. Justice Prosser. Mr. Buting.
Before you leave, I wonder if you could address the alleged blood under the fingernails.
Sure. I'd be happy to. The
toenails.
It's important to the key about the blood is that, first of all, it was never identified as any type. It was never linked to any person, Armstrong, the victim, or anyone else. The tests that were done were hemostick tests that were just sort of presumptive tests that react positive. And then if there's blood, but also if there are other things, they can get false positives. And then she collected some samples underneath the fingernails, two big thumb fingernails and two big toes. And the expert testified that there was blood of human origin, but that's as far as she could say. She couldn't say it was the victim's blood or whose it was. And, in fact, our expert looked at it and found absolutely no blood whatsoever. Now, and the state argued, well, that's because she testified that she used it all up. But he looked not just at the swabs of that were taken, but also the microscope slide that is part of the record here that's attached to Dr. Blake's report, photographs showing a microscope slide with her signature, that is the crime lab expert's signature's date showing that she prepared it. So the blood really did nothing, and particularly in conjunction with the fact that the police determined that the individual did not clean up in the apartment, and yet they spent 2 days carefully going through Armstrong's car and found no evidence.
I just want to make sure I understand. Are you attempting to persuade the court that there was no blood found under the fingernails and toenails of Mr. Armstrong?
I believe that's what Dr. Blake found. Now, the state has an argument of why that could be, and there may still have been blood, minute traces. But my point is, it really doesn't matter, because it was never typed or linked to the crime at all.
Thank you, Mr. Buding. Mr. Shedd, you've been introduced by Mr. Buting as a member in good standing the last time you looked in the office.
Yes.
All right. You're admitted
pro hoc.
Pardon?
I've been pro hoc on this case since 1994.
Right. Fine. You are admitted pro hoc vicita.
Thank you very much for the privilege of being here. Before I discuss why I believe the Court of Appeals misapplied the McCallum test of this court in reasoning about the evidence, just two quick forensic points. One, Justice Rogensack, you were right on the issue of the hairs. But one thing that we know about microscopic hair comparison is that it's still relied upon to exclude where it is now seen as having at least an 11% false positive rate by the FBI itself with mitochondrial DNA testing is in the inclusions. So the record is clear that there's not a hair from Ralph Armstrong that is found at that crime scene. What's really important is that the two hairs that they said were microscopically consistent and then in conclusion said came from Mr. Armstrong, that's what the jury was looking at. That was what was in dispute. And we now know that's false, just as we know that he cannot be included as the donor of the semen, which is something that the jury was told, and that's a false fact.
Counsel, I recall her testimony as saying more than 91% of the time you cannot identify from which individual a hair came. So I don't think she ever said that the hair came from Mr. Armstrong.
No, she didn't. Her testimony in that respect was scientifically fine. My point is, in terms of looking at the weight of the evidence and what Mr. Buting said, is that the prosecutor told the jury, in emphasizing the weight of this testimony, that both of those hairs came from Mr. Armstrong.
I have his closing argument, and that is not how I read what he said.
Well, I think we have it here.
On page 22 of the closing argument.
I think precisely what he said on page 20 is, pointing to the photograph, this is it, indicating the belt lying on top of Charisse Camp's body. Two of the defendant's hairs were on this robe. But I think the real point here is, and if I could go to the McCallum test for a second, is that it seemed to, the first point where we think the Court of Appeals went off track here in terms of looking at McCallum is that it seemed to, and the Avery case also makes this mistake, we believe, is that it says that there must be clear and convincing evidence of a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And as we read McCallum, and I think the amicus briefs are very helpful in this regard, is as to that fifth prong, the all-important prong, it did not appear that this court was layering what we might characterize as an almost incomprehensible double burden. The court of McCallum said the first four factual matters have to be proven by clear and convincing evidence, and that's been done here. But then it goes on to say, then the court should look at whether or not there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome using an outcome determinative test. And as you recall, the Chief Justice was calling for what I'll characterize as a worthy of confidence reasonable probability test.
Let me just double back.
Yeah.
As I see it, there are three issues in this fifth prong. Who has the burden of proof, right?
Yes.
And your position is?
Our position is we have the burden of showing there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome. But what we are saying is this court did not require, and the Court of Appeals and the Avery Court, I think, incorrectly require that we prove a reasonable probability of a different outcome by clear and convincing evidence.
Okay, that's the second issue. And the third one, as I see it, which may not be the way you see it, is, seems to me, when you look at the Avery test and you look at McCallum for the majority, McCallum says, or can be read to say, that the issue of whether there's a reasonable probability that the jury would reach a different result, you look back
yes.
to the original trial and say, if they had the whole schmear, everything, would your confidence be undermined if you look
yes.
at that? And Avery says, let's pretend we're going to have a trial tomorrow.
That's exactly right. And and this court, the Court of Appeals, went further, and we claim even may have crossed the constitutional line in terms of the jury trial guarantee.
So you do claim it because
yes.
they're pretending they're sitting as
a
jury.
We have to do a trial. Now, looking back at what McCallum says, which I think is clearly correct, and that is you have to look at this evidence in context. Let's go back to the Harris, Justice Rugensack, and look at the testimony of Ricky Uribe, because Ricky Uribe is the only eyewitness. Now, it is true that his testimony was admitted, even though it was hypnotically re-enhanced enhanced testimony. But let's look at it from the point of view of the context of the trial and what this jury heard. A reasonable juror would say, aha, here's Mr. Uribe. He was hypnotized. That worries me. He recanted his identification, and we recanted his recantation. That's worrying. He originally said that the assailant was his height, which is 5'5" tall. Mr. Armstrong is 6'2". That's a big difference, especially when one is estimating in relation to one's own height to see somebody that much taller. He also, admittedly, there was a battle of experts at the trial with respect to the reliability of the hypnotically enhanced recollection and certain prophylactic rules, but it is undisputed that those rules, which this court adopted as saying could make hypnotically enhanced recollection admissible, that's not the same as weight, but admissible, but those rules were violated because a police officer was in the session. The police officer had pictures of Mr. Armstrong's car, which Mr. Uribe identified. The police officer admitted he had a picture of Mr. Armstrong himself, and Mr. Uribe testified that he saw that picture.
In regard to Mr. Uribe's testimony,
yes.
we've already reviewed that and we've already affirmed it. Are you asking us to overturn
that? That's exactly the fallacy, because this is a de novo review. Judge Fiedler was not even the trial judge. Judge Torfey, unfortunately, couldn't review it. But beyond that, that is exactly the vice that of the Avery analysis and the Court of Appeals analysis here. You can't take these false facts about the crime scene and not relate it to Uribe's testimony. You must go back and look at the weight of Uribe's testimony. A reasonable juror might say, well, he got all these things wrong. There was it was hypnotically enhanced recollection. There was admittedly suggestion to the witness with respect to the height. He recanted and recanted his recantation. So all of this, there's expert testimony in the case that the human eye couldn't even distinguish what Uribe was set to testify. A reasonable juror might look at all of that and said, these give me problems with the identification of Uribe, which is, of course, critical, but would be reassured. Why would a reasonable juror be reassured? Aha! there are two hairs that are consistent with Mr. Armstrong, not one, but two, in a very probative place. There is semen on the robe from which he can't be excluded. There's a sex motive alleged in this case, so that could be his semen and his hairs. And so the crime scene evidence tends to resolve doubts that a reasonable juror would have about the identification. The problem with the way the Court of Appeals reviewed it and the way that you have just noted they reviewed it is they're looking at it as a sufficiency of the evidence review. That's not what should be going on here. One should be looking at how the false facts here would have affected the jury. That's what McCallum indicates. Frankly, when you look at the Delma Banks case recently decided.
Let me interrupt you at this point. One thing that troubles me in the argument is that I have some concern about whether McCallum is the correct test to apply here rather than Avery. And my concern is that McCallum was a recantation situation. Now, I understand that Ricky recanted and then recanted the recantation, but that isn't really the focus right now. And so I'm wondering, is McCallum really the correct test to apply?
Well, let's be clear about McCallum. As I understand McCallum, this Court said that they did not say that one had to have clear and convincing evidence of a reasonable probability. So that's one difference.
Use that term. I agree with you.
So that's one difference. And that, frankly, is a dispositive difference in terms of the way the Court of Appeals reasoned about it. Court of Appeals itself said, looking at this evidence, we can't tell whether he's guilty or innocent. A jury could easily, in their terms, believe that he was innocent. That's number one. Number two, so they didn't follow McCallum with respect to that. They didn't follow McCallum, and this is the key, in terms of putting the new evidence. There was a recantation. Here it's even stronger. Recantations, mere recantations in newly discovered evidence cases across the country are disfavored forms of evidence. As they should be in a sense, because they're mere testimonial issues where people make judgments about credibility. What's different about this case and this class of cases is that we have scientific proof of false facts. The concerns about finality expressed in the United States Supreme Court by Justice Rehnquist's plurality in Herrera, which I always thought was the only good, the really best argument, is how do we know that a fact-finding 20 years later would be more reliable? And in this class of cases where there's scientific evidence that proves false facts were presented to the jury, that is much more powerful set of cases than recantations. Indeed, what I would propose to this Court is that you would even modify McCallum in this respect, and that is in false fact cases, this class of cases, it is imperative that you not use the reasonable probability outcome determinative test. This is exactly the kind of case where it's appropriate to use the worthy of confidence form of the reasonable probability test. In fact, the Court of Appeals itself acknowledged it. The Court of Appeals said that's a rational distinction. It troubles us that there were false facts in this case given to the jury.
Are you now taking it to the harmless error approach?
Well, that's different. We did argue harmless error, but I'm saying there's gradations. On the one hand, there's harmless error.
Mm-hmm.
On the other step up, I would say, is what we call the worthy of confidence reasonable
probability
test.
Undermining the confidence in? Is that
I'm sorry?
Undermining the confidence in the outcome?
Yes. The same kind of test that one applies in an exculpatory evidence case, we would say, should apply in a newly discovered evidence case where there's scientific proof of false facts. That's not a lot of cases. Those are very rare. And the reason that kind of test should be done is, number one, as I said before, finality considerations are not as strong because we know in a false fact case we are going to get a more reliable fact-finding 20 years later because the jury will not be thinking in terms of even buttressing something like a rebase questionable identification that's automatically enhanced and recanted that there's any physical evidence to corroborate it. Yes.
If you'd like to take a breath, I'd like to get a question in.
Sure. I'm a red light, so I have to talk fast.
I understand. I'm concerned about one of the points, and perhaps I should ask this of Mr. Buting when he comes back up for rebuttal, but he seemed to indicate that the blood evidence was never really linked to Mr. Armstrong, and therefore you all really weren't relying on this. But I'm looking at page 21 of the closing argument of the prosecutor, which says the defendant's fingers were tested down at the police station. Joe Wagner ran the hemosticks around the cuticles and under the thumb and under the nails and around the cuticles of every finger, and lo and behold, there was blood under every fingernail, every single one. That was Sharice Camp's blood.
I understand.
Given that argument,
yes.
I guess I'm curious as to why the defense is not relying on that as well in arguing the newly discovered evidence.
Oh, well, we do rely on it. I don't mean to suggest otherwise. The truth is that the prosecutor in his closing argument, when discussing both the blood and the hair, went beyond the science that his own witnesses put on. A hemostick test is just a presumptive test that blood could be present. All right? Doesn't mean there are many other substances that could create a false positive. Dr. Blake's report here shows that he examined not only swabs, but he also looked at a slide. And let's just be clear how this works. They took the swabs, as Judge Sputnik pointed out, and they put it under all the cuticles. Then they took the swab and they would put it on a slide. Okay? Then they went to the swabs and they did the chemical analysis to see if there was a presumptive test for blood. When Dr. Blake went back and looked at the slide, right, the slide, he found no evidence that there was human blood there. So this is more proof on our side that there wasn't ever blood there. The scientific evidence in this case only raised an inference. It was a presumptive test for blood. And as Mr. Buting said, there are many reasons that one can have even this kind of reaction from stuff under the fingernails. But the blood here was never typed as in any way coming from the victim. And in fact, when you look at all this DNA, right, the DNA shows the hairs aren't from Mr. Armstrong. The DNA shows that the semen isn't from Mr. Armstrong, thereby rebutting the sex motive, thereby undermining Ricky Uribe's testimony, because that is not entitled to great weight no matter how you look at this. But all of a sudden, without the crime scene evidence, that looks a lot less reliable. And it also goes to this blood evidence and the crime scene evidence. If there's nothing whatsoever that links him to the crime scene, and if indeed this jury was under the false impression that hairs and blood could link him, all of a sudden, doesn't it become much more significant that there's not a trace of blood or any fibers or anything in his car, and there's no evidence of cleanup after this bloody murder? You know, that fact also, when you look at this new DNA, right, is something that a jury would begin to take much more seriously. So the bottom line here is that the Court of Appeals, and frankly the Avery Court, keeps on missing the point that you have to look at these false facts, this new evidence, in the context of the original trial. And if there isn't a greater lesson than Avery, I don't know what is, because the Avery Court said, aha, and it was weaker because it was just DNA from fingernail scraping showing that there was an additional person. But they never took that into the context of the suppressed exculpatory evidence that there was somebody else out there. They never looked at those two things together. And thank God there could be a DNA test that linked those two people subsequently and showed that this was an innocent man. We may not have that luck with Mr. Armstrong because we may not be able to find people's hairs. There's no mitochondrial data bank.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sheff. We'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal by Mr. Buting. Sally L. Wellman, Assistant Attorney General, representing the State of Wisconsin. Ms. Wellman.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the State of Wisconsin in this case. I know we want to talk about the legal issues, but let me just clarify a couple of really important facts. First of all, and we discussed this at page 3 in our brief, the trial court at the post-conviction motion hearing made a specific finding that Armstrong did not prove by clear and convincing evidence that there was no blood or had never been any blood under his fingernails or on the hemosticks. That is a factual finding by a failure to prove. The court did not accept Mr. Armstrong's theory that there never had been any blood under his fingernails or toenails or thumbnails because there wasn't any evidence now. In the record, the expert testified very, very clearly She used all the material up. All of the material on the cloth she put in solution, it was all used up. She said it on both direct exam and cross-examination. That's why she couldn't type it. She didn't have enough of it. Armstrong obviously got hands on his blood on his hands when he killed the victim. He did a good job of cleaning his hands up, but not good enough. But he didn't leave enough material to do typing. So that is a factual finding that's binding here. Also, I urge the court to look closely at the closing argument. Of course, the prosecutor urged the jury to draw the inference that the hairs that were consistent with Armstrong's standard were from Armstrong.
Actually, Ms. Wellman, as I understand the argument, what he said was on page 20, two of the defendant's hairs were on this rope. He wasn't arguing for an inference. He said the hairs were on the rope.
Well, that's an inference. That's two inferences. One, the inference is that the hairs were from Armstrong, and two, that they were on the rope. It was a reasonable inference at the time. It was never challenged at the time as being an unreasonable inference or an improper argument.
But I guess what I'm getting at is that you're arguing that he was arguing a reasonable inference. I don't see the word inference anywhere in that statement. This was a statement to the jury that the hairs were on the rope.
Well, I guess I would say that all of the things that the prosecutor urges the jury to accept and draw one is based on inferences.
Or facts. Prosecutors are allowed to argue facts or reasonable inferences.
Right.
If it's stated as a fact, that's the way it comes out, at least in the argument.
I don't think that prosecutors are required during closing argument to specify, to distinguish between facts and inferences. They argue it all together, as does the defense. And in this case, the defense did present all of the arguments that the hairs do not link to a specific person. You can't do that with microscopic hair testing, that the hair could have come from anywhere at any time. It could have drifted onto the robe belt before the crime ever occurred and was just on there when it was picked up and put on the body. It could have drifted on afterwards, after the crime, but before the robe belt was removed as evidence. The defense also argued that the semen on the bathrobe was equally consistent with the boyfriend, Brian Doman, who had a sexual relationship with Camps, who saw her frequently while she was away at college. And the placement of the semen stains was consistent with someone who had sexual intercourse and then got up, put on the robe, and sat down. Obviously, the victim did not do any of that after she was murdered. I mean, she was murdered in the bed.
Could I ask you a factual question? The defendant testified at the trial.
Yes, he did.
And I think he said that after he left his girlfriend, that he went to his apartment?
Yes.
And he saw his brother?
Right.
But his brother never testified at the trial?
That's right.
Why is that?
The defense chose not to call him. I don't know. I mean, there is no fact in the record about why he didn't call him, but he didn't call him. He also said that during that time period, that just happens to conveniently coincide with the time period that Aurelia saw him at going in and out the apartment building, that he made a number of telephone calls, but he didn't give the names of any people he called or tried to call. He didn't provide any phone records of those calls. Moreover, he said that he got back to Jane Mays, his girlfriend's apartment, at about 1 o'clock. Now, at one point, Jane agreed that it probably was about 1 o'clock. She was already in bed sleeping. But she also admitted it could have been as late as 3 or 3:30. She also admitted that the morning afterwards, before the body had been discovered, before anyone except the killer knew that Cherise Camps was dead, she had told a girlfriend that Ralph didn't come home at all. And she made the comment, because the girlfriend had said, "I just saw Ralph." And she said, "Well, you didn't see him coming with me. He wasn't with me. Maybe he was with Cherise." He also testified that he parked in a place and went in the back entrance, which is kind of like a fire escape, because he didn't have a key to the front door. That would explain, he says, why all the people who are out milling around on the front side of the building, on the State Street side, who are all out there because there was a film company filming James Brown, I think, some musician. Why, they were all out about that time. Nobody saw Ralph come in at that time. The door was propped open. He could have gotten in the front door. He didn't park where he would have naturally gone in the back door. He got a parking ticket the next morning that shows he lied about that, too.
Is the defendant relying on some either new or additional information from his brother now?
No, he isn't.
I thought there was something about explaining the $400.
I think I know what you're referring to. At trial, Ralph testified. Let me start back up a little bit. Ralph gave Cherise Camps $400 in cash Monday night. She was murdered in the wee hours of Tuesday morning. He gave her $400 in cash Monday night to repay her boyfriend who had loaned Ralph $400. After Cherise was murdered, that $400 was never found. There were no other signs of robbery, but that $400 was missing. The next morning, Ralph made a bank deposit of $315 in mostly large bills. The bank teller who dealt with him regularly said he didn't usually make large deposits and he didn't usually deposit large bills. Ralph says, in part, he had that kind of money because his brother Steve had given him money. Even though when Steve got up here, his clothes didn't come with him when he traveled. They somehow got lost in transit or didn't get transferred to the right bus. So Ralph spent money to buy Steve clothes. And previously, Ralph had sent money to Steve because Steve called him or wired him and said, I need some money. I don't have any money. So the state disproved or cast great credibility doubts on that story. But Steve never testified about anything, and there's no reliance on Steve now. That was all at the trial.
Counsel, in response to Justice Butler's questions regarding the closing statement, and I think he was referring to page 20 of the transcript, it indicates that the prosecutor stated, this is it, lying on top of Cherise Camp's body. Two of the defendant's hairs were on this robe. And further in that transcript on the same page, it states, the defendant's hair in every place in that apartment was consistent with his killing Cherise Camps. As I read specifically the first one of those two statements, there is no hairs consistent with or hairs similar to, but rather the declarative statement that two of the defendant's hairs were on this robe. Why, I hear you fighting that. And I say, why are you fighting that? I mean, you know, it says what it says, and it doesn't say it's consistent with, it doesn't say similar to, it's a declaratory statement. And he's saying it is, so.
Right, it is, and it was proper argument. The fact that there's now evidence that shows that those two had hairs, which actually are on the belt, not the robe, I don't know if that's a typo or a misstatement, if they could not have come from Ralph, then we now know it's incorrect. But the question is, or the issue in this case is, if that evidence had existed and the defense could have presented it at the original trial in 1981, would it have made a difference to the jury? In the terms of a reasonable probability, is there a reasonable probability in light of all of the other evidence the state had of guilt that is not undermined by the fact that he was excluded as the source of two head hairs?
And part of that inquiry depends on how the evidence is used, including used at closing statement. And, I see the evidence is coming in as saying this is similar to, this is consistent with, but it's used as though it is an actual fact that it is. And so I see the closing statement with regard to the sections that I've indicated being an exaggeration of the evidence that was actually received.
Well, I wouldn't agree that it's an exaggeration. I think it's a reasonable inference. But the point is we don't focus on this as if it were constitutional error for the evidence to come in the first place or for the argument to be made.
As a trial judge, if I was sitting and listening to closing argument and I had the prosecutor saying, this is the hair of the defendant, this is the blood of the defendant, when the underlying testimony offered at trial was never this is the hair, was never this is the blood, but given the kinds of testing, the expert would say this is similar to or this is consistent with. We heard that all the time. I would sustain this objection to a prosecutor. You can call it exaggerating or you can call it distorting the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was no objection at the time. There's never been an argument in his many, many previous appeals or federal habeas that that was error. And I think what we have to look at now is if this were either tried anew with all of the same evidence we had before, all of the, you know, the eyewitness identification evidence, the money evidence, the hemostick evidence, his movements, his alibi that were all disproved at trial. If we had that and we had the evidence that he can be excluded as two-head as the source of the two-head hairs on the bathrobe belt, is there a reasonable probability that a jury would acquit or would have acquitted instead of convicting? And the answer is no, regardless of what test you use.
All right. Let's talk about the tests, okay? Because this is a court which deals with law, although we then have to apply the law to the facts, and I understand why both you and defense are arguing the facts. Now, as I understand Avery, and as I understand the application of Avery in this case, the test that the Court of Appeals is using is the burden of proof is on the defendant to prove by clear and convincing evidence that in a new trial, the jury is given all this new evidence plus the old that's still good, the jury would not reach a different outcome. Have I stated the test roughly correctly?
I think that's correct.
All right. As I read McCallum, although I said in my concurrence there are different ways that McCallum states the test, at least one line of cases can be interpreted. You don't look forward and guesstimate what the jury would do. You look back and say, had the jury had this evidence in this particular case on the basis of the record, do you have doubt about the outcome? Is the outcome in question for you? That kind of test, the Strickland test.
I guess I don't agree with the last part.
I know, because it's not Avery, and that's what I'm pressing you on. You want the Avery test.
Well, I don't, the way you said the last part of what you say is a McCallum test, I think they used an outcome determinative. I agree, they focused on looking at if we had the trial testimony accusation and the recantation, right, would the jury have a reasonable doubt of guilt? And I see that as
that
still, right. But I guess I don't see that significant of a difference in that, in the sense that, and maybe it's just fact-driven, because in McCallum, the only evidence the state had inculpating the defendant was the victim's testimony that he had sexually assaulted her. And if they were going to retry him, that's all they could put in. So, of course, at a new trial, the evidence would be the accusation and the recantation. In other kinds of cases, it may well be, as in this case, if we had a new trial, the state would not put in Wagner's testimony that the hair was consistent or similar, assuming that you know, the exclusion was valid and that the DNA tests were done right and chain of custody was proven and all that. We would say, right, those two hairs have now been shown not to be his. And everybody would go from there. All of the other evidence, of course, would still be presented. And I don't see that as terribly different from saying, if in 1981, The defense could have presented the DNA evidence and had done so, and therefore the other hair testimony evidence about being consistent wouldn't have come in. The question still is, has he shown by clear and convincing evidence that there's a reasonable probability that a jury would acquit instead of convict?
Ms. Wellman, let me stop you at that point. In McCallum, we didn't seem to require the standard of clear and convincing evidence on that fifth prong. Where do you find that?
Well, it was said in the cases prior to Avery as well as Avery. I believe Bruton used it, Coogan used it. If I went back far enough, probably cases before Bruton all say, and Bruton, I think, made it the clearest that you have to prove all five prongs by clear and convincing evidence.
But McCallum is the latest decision from this court.
Right.
Five voice factors, right?
Right. And what McCallum did is it made it clear that the first four factors you have to prove by clear and convincing evidence, and then it simply said, and you have to prove reasonable probability that the result of the new trial would be different. And I don't, it didn't really talk about why it didn't include, if it didn't intend to include that clear and convincing. Now, I agree, an argument I think could be made that when you get to that fifth prong, you could treat it as a question of law because it's similar to prejudice in ineffective assistance and harmless error, which are both treated as questions of law. But even in those contexts, we put the burden on a party. The strength of the inferences you have to draw, I think in that last burden, that's where the clear and convincing evidence standard comes in. If you look at the strength of the inference the defense is asking you to draw, and in this case, the inference that those hairs must have come from the real killer, they must have come from someone else, is a very weak inference and certainly not strong enough.
Ms. Wellman, dealing specifically with that issue, given the way the blood evidence was used at the first trial, and we understand that there may or may not be used now as to whether or not there was hemostatic evidence, but there are certainly different inferences that can be raised that the defense has. Given the semen evidence that we now know is different, and given the hair evidence that we now know is different, and how it was used in the first trial, I guess I'm curious as to why, and I think Mr. Buting alluded to this in his argument, 751.06 doesn't apply in an appeal in the Supreme Court if it appears from the record that the real controversy has not been fully tried. It seems quite obvious from the way the trial went the first time that the real controversy really didn't get tried. And so I'm wondering why we would not apply 751.06 perhaps the way it was done in Hicks under the circumstances of this case.
Because we believe the real controversy absolutely was tried. The real controversy was, did Ralph Armstrong rape and kill Charisse Camps? And we proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he did. In total context, the hair evidence, the semen evidence, particularly given how the defense argued it in closing argument and cross-examined the witness, we do not agree that we don't still have the blood evidence. We absolutely believe we still have evidence that he had blood under every fingernail, and blood of human origin under his toenails and thumbnails. In light of all of the other evidence, eyewitness identification, sure, the defense now trashes Ricky Arrivia's character and credibility. They did it all the way through. This court allowed the evidence in, and in the prior post-conviction motion appeal, the Court of Appeals, looking at all of that, said Ricky Arrivia's identification testimony remained unshaken. The state demolished his alibi evidence.
Is it significant that there was another witness who also was hypnotized and that the trial court didn't conduct any pretrial examination of that?
No, because the defense didn't ask for one. Armstrong, this court's earlier decision in Armstrong, very clearly says, upon motion of the party who wants to keep out the evidence of a witness who has been hypnotized, the court has to hold a hearing. There was no request for a hearing regarding Roy Chaffee. And then there's never any claim that that evidence wasn't disclosed. It was in the police reports. The defense chose not to ask for a hearing.
So there's a waiver, basically?
Well, absolutely. I mean, 25 years later, he can't now challenge that evidence. Besides which, her testimony was really, even the defense admitted this earlier in the post-conviction hearing, was pretty insignificant. She might have heard some music at a certain time. It might have been Grand Funk, which Ralph Armstrong, along with, I assume, a number of other young people at that time, liked that group.
Ms. Wellman, I'm extremely troubled by paragraph 34 of the Court of Appeals decision in the following two sentences. This is an extremely close case. It's at Appendix 115 of the red, of the blue brief, I guess. This is an extremely close case. It is not possible to tell from this record whether Armstrong is innocent or guilty. Given that statement, I guess my question is, should we, and if we should, how can we ignore the implications that are behind that?
I have two responses to that. One is, they don't explain why they think it's an extremely close case, and we don't view this as an extremely close case, nor did the Court of Appeals, a different panel of the same court, at the earlier post-conviction motion appeal. They also, I just don't understand what they exactly mean when they say it's not, from a legal perspective, what it matters that they say it is not possible to tell from this record whether Armstrong is innocent or guilty. It's never possible for the appellate court to say, I mean, that's never the question before an appellate court. The question is always, has a certain legal standard been met or not? Even in a sufficiency of the evidence case, you're not deciding whether it's possible to tell from the record whether he's innocent or guilty in the sense they seem to mean. You're deciding whether there was sufficient evidence that, if believed by the jury, would support the conviction. So I'm not sure.
How does that fit with paragraph 37? However, the proper inquiry is whether a hypothetical future jury at retrial would find Armstrong not guilty based on the totality of the evidence, including the new evidence obtained from advances in DNA testing, citing Boyce. And that's the test they apply. They apply what would a new jury do on all this evidence, and they say, find him guilty. So aren't they doing exactly what you say they shouldn't do? And how does that square with, it's not possible to tell from this record whether he's innocent or guilty? Then their next sentence in 37, which is why I keep stressing just what is the legal standard here. Our job, they say, is not to determine how, if at all, the false evidence influenced the jury in the first trial, which, as I understand it, is really what the defendants want as the test.
Right, I agree. That's what the defendants want, and I think that is absolutely not the test, because...
And that's what Avery said.
Right.
Avery said that is not the test. That was the issue in Avery. Okay, so how do you square what the proper inquiry is with Justice Butler's question about what the court says in paragraph 34?
I guess I don't see those two statements as the court doing exactly what I'm saying it can't do, which is decide guilt or innocent. What it's doing is saying, if we look at this case, if it were tried now with all the same old evidence except the Wagner-Hare evidence and the new DNA evidence, is there a reasonable probability? That's a way of saying, what would the jury do? That's not saying, is he guilty or innocent? Do we think he's guilty or innocent? I don't see it as being that different from what we always do when we're looking at any kind of basis for a new trial, whether it's harmless error, the Strickland test, or the newly discovered evidence test. I mean, there are differences in who bears burdens, but we're always trying to make an assessment of, in light of the whole picture, what's the probability, the likelihood, however we have to, each party has to prove it, of a different result. Now, in the harmless error and Strickland context, I do think it's different, because when there's an allegation of constitutional error, what you're looking at is not just the error per se, but the possibility that the defendant was denied a fair trial because the error is what led to the verdict.
So in a new trial, in this instance, if there were to be a new trial, using the standard that the Court of Appeals used in paragraph 37, what is the evidence that the state would introduce that would show Mr. Armstrong's guilt?
Well, I think when we say if there were a new trial, we take everything as it was presented at the first trial except the evidence that we now wouldn't offer, which would be the Wagner hair evidence. So we would have a Ricky Rubio's identification testimony. We would have the evidence that Armstrong gave Camps $400 in large bills the very hours before she was murdered. That money was missing from her apartments afterwards, and he had almost exactly that amount of money the next morning. The evidence that his alibi was completely demolished. He had no backup to show that he was at his apartment and in transit between his apartment and Jane May's apartment at the time that the murder would have been occurring, that the Hyman Rivas saw him go in there. We still have, of course, evidence that he was in the apartment. His fingerprint was on the water pipe, the bond. Of course, he tries to say that's because I was there earlier, but we have all the evidence showing that given the times that other people said he was at other different places trying to buy cocaine and so forth, that his story that he could have been at Charisse's earlier instead of later was not true. We would have all of that evidence as well as the presumptive blood under the fingernails and the human blood under the toenails and thumbnails.
You would also have the testimony, wouldn't you, about his lying about the person from whom he bought the cocaine.
Right. That's it. Thank you for mentioning that. The stories that he first told the police didn't match up with his trial testimony at all. He kept changing his story as he learned the state's facts and knew that the state could prove he was certain places at certain times. But I think that
could I ask you, it's not quite clear to me in evaluating the probabilities here, how does one factor in what Mr. Buting would do with the new DNA evidence about the hair and the semen?
Well, I think you look at the inference he would obviously ask the jury to draw, I assume, if he had been able to present this at the original trial or at a new trial, is that the hair most likely got on the bathrobe belt from the person who was killing her and raping her or had killed and raped her, picked it up and placed it over her. The state, of course, would argue, you know, hair is very mobile. It could have been on the belt easily before that and was just on the belt when the killer picked it up and put it over the body. It could even have been placed on the belt after the murder during the crime scene investigation. The first person who found the body was Jane May. And Jane May testified that she walked into the apartment, she walked right up to the bed, put her hand this high, I don't know how high that is, but this high above the body, saw the horrifying dead body of Charisse Camps and ran to tried to use the telephone and it wasn't working and ran to get help to get someone to call the police. We also know that the police arrived sometime around 1:15 and the evidence wasn't bagged until almost 3 hours later. There were numerous police officers in the apartment. Joe Wagner was in the apartment. It was a hot summer day. The fan may have been on. There actually is no testimony in the trial record that the hair was seen on the belt when the belt was bagged as evidence. The police officer who picked it up said that he very carefully removed the belt and put it in a bag. He wasn't asked and he didn't testify if there was any hair on it at that time. He was asked later on cross-examination, well, if there had been hair on it, would you have bagged it separately? And he said no. So, I mean, it could have gotten on there at any time. You know, DNA evidence, of course, can be extremely powerful in some cases. It was in the subsequent Avery exoneration case. But that was for two reasons. One, it was pubic hair from the sexual assault victim's pubic hair combings. It wasn't just in an apartment or on the floor or even on a bedspread. And two, it links specifically to another known identified sex offender who was not in prison at the time and could have committed the crime in the area. DNA evidence may be very powerful depending on what it is and where it is and how it fits with the rest of the case. Obviously, if you have semen in a victim's vaginal cavity and no evidence that she had any sexual relations at the relevant time except for the sexual assault and only one perpetrator, and that evidence later turns out not to be the defendant's, that's very powerful. But when it's head hair on an object that could have gotten on there other ways, it doesn't lead you to draw a powerful inference that the only way the hair could have gotten on there is if it was the perpetrator's.
In a bloody scene,
in a rape, the state would have no physical evidence that directly linked the blood, the semen, or the hair to this defendant. The state would have eyewitness identification, lack of an alibi, lying on the stand, etc. But there would be no physical evidence scientifically directly linking this defendant to the crime scene. There's fingerprints. He may have been there before or not. But
well, I disagree to the extent that we would still have the blood evidence.
That there was blood.
That there was blood, and there was blood
tied to her.
We cannot tie it to her because there wasn't enough left.
That's right.
We also have other hair that has not been disproven as his. A hair in the sink was consistent with his.
Did they test it?
I'm sorry, no, the defense has chosen not to test it.
Did you test it?
I don't recall any record of that.
Okay. That certainly could be done on retrial if the court would order a retrial, is that correct?
If it's still available, and I don't know that either. Go ahead.
From your vast experience, how often is there a retrial after 25 years?
It's extremely rare, and for good reason. I mean, when we talk in this theory, if you look at the Avery test, you know, at a new trial, what would happen? I mean, that is a theory, and we're sort of saying, well, let's say the new evidence were injected into what happened at trial. But as a practical matter, we have to remember the severe disadvantage the state is at if we really would have to retry this case now.
So then why not look at the evidence as how it related to the original trial?
I'm sorry?
If instead of talking theoretical values, then why not look at the evidence in terms of how it relates to the original trial?
I think that's fine. That's fine. Except, of course, obviously we wouldn't put in the Joe Wagner testimony that the hair was consistent or similar because we wouldn't think that it was any longer any relevant.
I thought that was the test that the defendant wanted that you didn't.
No, I think we disagree is the defendant wants to only have to prove a lack of confidence in the outcome, not outcome determinative. That's where we draw the line.
You want the appellate court to act as if it were a jury. And
no, I'm sorry. I didn't
know that. Then what does outcome determinative mean? I don't know what it means.
Well, the traditional harmless error test is an outcome determinative test in terms of would it have influenced, well, that.
Would it have influenced, would it have changed the result?
All right, that's right. That, I stand corrected on that. But I don't think saying that would it make it an outcome determinative is saying we're putting ourselves in the place of the jury. We're evaluating the extent to which the newly discovered evidence would undermine or undercut the other evidence of guilt. And, you know, this is why it kind of slides into the interest of justice, because let's remember in Hicks, I mean, superficially, Hicks seems like this case because it involved hair evidence that turned out not to be the defendant's, and the prosecutor argued inferences that now then had been disproven. But in Hicks, two things are very, very different. One is you had very little other evidence. She had an eyewitness identification, but she only saw her assailant for a few minutes, before he actually attacked her. And it was critical there that the victim was white, the assailant was black. The victim said no black man had ever been in her apartment.
Now, the problem, though, I didn't want to get into Hicks. I didn't agree with Hicks. I was in the dissent because of the fact that the hair was a problem also in Hicks because other people had come and gone in that apartment, as you raised here.
But that's right. And I don't disagree that I disagree with Hicks, too, but it's the law. But it is distinguishable here because here there never was a suggestion that Armstrong's hair could only have been in the apartment if he was there when he murdered her because he had never been there before. He had been there before. He'd been there that very night, and he said he'd been there on other occasions. So it didn't have, the state's evidence at the trial didn't have the same inference as in Hicks. And, of course, in Hicks you didn't have all the other circumstantial evidence linking the defendant to the crime as we do here.
Well, I thought he had never been in her apartment ever until that night, and that's why there was such a reliance by Norsetter on the time frame, because his fingerprint was in the apartment, so it had to be accounted for. Clearly, he'd been there, and I thought the reason the time frame was so important was that he'd never been in the apartment before.
No, he testified, Ralph Armstrong testified that he had been to Sharice's apartment on two or three prior occasions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wellman.
Thank you.
Mr. Beauty.
This is what the prosecutor argued about that hair. Quote, the defendant would want you to believe that hair kind of floats around and lands where it was and has a mind of its own. There is no explanation for why that hair was found in every place the defendant was except that he murdered Sharice Camps. That's what they said. Now, of course, they're going 100%, now they're adopting that theory. But the reality is that if that jury or any jury accepts the state's original theory at trial that the hairs came from the killer because that bathroom belt is the only item we know for sure was handled by the killer. And there's two head hairs, not just one person, hair from one person, but two that match.
Counselor, didn't defense counsel, though, work on the evidence about the head hair in a little different matter, trying to point out that it wasn't all as consistent as the prosecutor represented?
I'm sorry, it wasn't all what?
It wasn't as consistent as the prosecutor represented.
Yes, that was, you know, the defense, though, if you can imagine the difficulty that the defense attorney must have had to try and explain away one coincidence too many, that his semen could be on there, he's not excluded from the semen, and his hairs appear to be on that very belt that was handled by the killer. That's very powerful evidence. And you must also, when you think about the test to formulate here, remember which party gained the unfair advantage, or what ultimately is the unfair advantage here. The state got the benefit. That's why, in some respects, harmless error has some merit in a test like this, because when there's false facts that are introduced to a jury, the one party benefits, in this case the state. And when we look at harmless error cases, we say, therefore, it's the burden of that party to show that the error did not affect the jury's verdict. Now, you don't necessarily have to go that far, because when you look at what the court's interest of justice discretionary reversal power is, it's very similar to that anyway. And one thing that was mentioned in the briefs that I want to at least touch on with the court is what the legislature has said about all this. 97407, which by mere timing wasn't actually enacted until Mr. Armstrong's case was already on appeal. The standard in that statute says nothing about clear and convincing evidence. What it says in subsection 10 is that once the tests come back, and that's what we're talking about here, once the tests come back, if they support the movement's claim, the court shall enter any order that, in the interest of justice, it's an interest of justice standard that applies in the new statute. Now, why should Mr. Armstrong not be treated the same? Why should he be required to have a higher burden? There's nothing to prevent him from refiling this whole motion and coming back on a 97407 and using that kind of a standard. So what the legislature also did is, and when they amended, they codified Bembenek by amending 805.16, they removed any statute of limitations from any newly discovered evidence, not just DNA cases. And what I think they're saying is, yes, we recognize this, that now the state would be at a disadvantage to have to retry this case 25 years later. But certainly in the cases of DNA, DNA really trumps finality, because DNA has really shaken the public's confidence in our criminal justice system when we see time after time after time people on death row who are exonerated. The public is worried. The Avery Commission is looking into all of this. There's been an outcry. There's been a reaction in the public. And the Court of Appeals, while recognizing that this is an extremely close case and can't tell whether Armstrong is innocent or guilty, still didn't give him relief. That's puzzling. The only explanation I have is that they just applied the wrong standard. They looked forward instead of looking back. And this Court should not do that.
But Mr. Buting, if Mr. Armstrong didn't commit this crime, wasn't at the house somewhere around midnight, 2-3 o'clock, somewhere in that area, he has to have been somewhere else. And I think his testimony was that he was with his brother part of that time, or very close to that time. Where's the brother?
I don't know why the brother wasn't called. I wasn't the trial attorney. I can't answer that. But
the brother now.
But what I would say to the Court, I would direct the Court's attention to Stewart versus State at 83 West 2nd 185. When the State argues that his alibi was demolished, I dispute that, and there's a timeline in there that shows that his testimony of where he went and all those movements are still consistent with the other evidence, but alibi testimony is not, even if proven to have been wrong, is not affirmative evidence of guilt. So even if Armstrong was lying about a lot of things, and he clearly did lie and admitted lying to the police about the cocaine and the source that he got it from and all of that, even if he was lying, that doesn't mean he's guilty of this crime. And if there's evidence that proves that, in fact, gives a reasonable inference, if not certainly reasonable doubt, that someone else's hair, the killer's hair, is on that belt, then it really doesn't matter where Armstrong was.
Are you doing the same thing that you object to the prosecuting attorney's doing? You're saying that because there are hairs on the belt that aren't his, we should believe the killer's hairs, just like the prosecutor asked the jury to believe because the hairs that were on the belt were consistent with Armstrong, but he said they were his hairs. And you're right, Mr. Sheck, it is on page 20, and thank you for finding that for me. It's the same kind of argument. And, you know, if this were the type of DNA evidence that was available in Avery's case where it couldn't have been him, I mean, it excludes him. My problem is how to evaluate evidence that certainly has some force but doesn't really exclude him.
Because what we're saying is that this Court doesn't have to find him innocent.
No, I understand that.
And we don't have to prove that he's innocent.
We have to evaluate
the evidence and look at it in the context of how the original jury would have seen it. And is there a reasonable doubt is all that's necessary. That's what I'm saying. Yes, it would be great if we could say that there's a registered sex offender who matches this hair like an Avery.
See, that's a very different test than you having to prove to us that this evidence shows by clear and convincing evidence there's a reasonable probability that the verdict would have been different. So you're not applying the test that comes out of Avery when you say that, right? I mean, that's the test. That's the fifth factor, right? Reasonable probability
of a different outcome. Right. Well, if you apply that test, it needs to be applied in the context of the way McAllen applied it, which is by looking, comparing it, holding up the two evidences at the
counsel, I'm sorry, we have to change the tape if this is going to proceed. So if you'd give us a minute.
Thank you.
Your red light is on, but you were answering the question of Justice Rubensack.
Thank you. Then to finish the when you ask what the standard should be, at a minimum, I think what this court should do is clarify that Avery was wrong when it applied the clear and convincing evidence burden to that fifth factor, that the standard of reasonable probability of a different outcome need not and should not be required to be have a double burden layered on top of it once those first four factors are done, at a minimum. And that in, I think in addition, when there's this false fact case where the evidence was actually introduced to the jury, not just additional evidence, the rational distinction, that in those cases that the reasonable probability should be defined the way it is in exculpatory evidence cases or Strickland, which is undermining the confidence in the verdict. Because that's really what this DNA result does, is it undermines the public's confidence in the reliability of the conviction of Ralph Armstrong.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Buting. Thank you, Mr. Sheck. And thank you, Ms. Wellman, for your arguments today relating to DNA and new evidence and overturning convictions. Mr. Sheck, you are no longer authorized to practice law in Wisconsin.
Come again.
Thank you. We'll take a few moments recess where to enable the students to leave and to enable other students to come in.